Your panel this morning is, to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Ann Gardner. I'm Leanne Dofino. We have one case set for oral submission with this panel. Then we change panels, and there is a second case set for oral submission. Everything else is submitted on briefs. So, since I understand both sides are ready, we'll begin if you'll call the case.
The court will now call Jimmy and Karen Lewis versus Bell Helicopter. And may it please the court, to argue for the appellant, Mr. Brian Davis, to argue for the athlete.
All right. You ready?
I don't think I'll forget your names, but if I may approach, y'all have got your name.
Oh, we do. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Glad to do it. I didn't know if this was being filmed for a live audience.
Well, we have a live audience.
Oh, I wasn't expecting all this in the great David Keller.
Well, then, thank you very much.
So, federal preemption. When I started trying to get my mind around this topic and started to think, like, how do y'all need to approach it, I came to the conclusion that federal preemption is not as easy as it looks, that it's a very fact-intensive inquiry, and the facts drive oftentimes whether or not federal preemption applies. And when you look at the facts with respect to the FAA and what we're here about today, I see a continuum of, on one side, you have public airports with freight and passengers, much like DFW. And then on the other hand, you have, at the other extreme, you have a heliport, a small heliport like the doctor had in the Wood case, where he simply built a heliport on his house for his own personal use.
But isn't the distinguishing feature in this case that the heliport, Bell's heliport's in Class D airspace?
Well, I don't see it that way, Judge. I don't think because it's in Class D airspace that you can't perform the analysis that I'm suggesting. I think that when you look at the analysis that I'm suggesting, this will work regardless of the fact that it's in Class D. In other words, what I'm thinking is that there are extremes that we can avoid, like the City of Burbank case, where you simply had the city council deciding we're not going to have flights over our homes from 11 to 7. And you can have it to, and the Benjamin case, there's two cases I want to talk about that I think set the stage for how you should view the facts in our case. The Benjamin case first said that the Federal Aviation Act provides a remedy in addition to the state law claims and common law causes of action. So they're setting the stage that, yes, you can have state law and common law claims. Then you have the Wood case that talks about that preemption is needed where you need to have a monolithic system of regulation, but that obviously does not reach down to the level of the location of small, relatively isolated, private-owned helistops. So under those circumstances, I think they have framed the issue correctly. Now, the mistake that I think those courts made was when they started writing about their opinion based, given this kind of holistic approach to how we're going to approach regulation, they kind of became too fact intensive. In other words, they looked at the facts of their own case rather than trying to come up with a framework for all of us in every case. And so the Benjamin case said that, well, it's not preempted if there's a violation of federal regulations or it pertains to airport operations. The Wood case talked about banning ground usage. And Bell has latched onto that. And they said, well, listen, that's a ground usage case, and what they're wanting to do is take care of flights. And I suggest to you that when you talk about just flights, that's not just one thing. That you have to look at the nature of the flights, and you have to consider all the facts pertaining to those flights. And you can't just say, well, they're just trying to ban flights, and they want a no-fly zone over their home. That's not it. What we're requesting is something very specific, and that I think that there's room in the law to allow a judge to craft an order that would address my client's concerns and not run afoul of preemption. And I think that you could put forth a multifactorial analysis for the trial judge to consider, or for a future court to consider, when deciding whether or not something's preempted in this particular area of the law. It'd be kind of like a Daubert or a Erie doctrine type analysis, where you look at a bunch of different factors. In this case, I think you look to where it's a public or private airport, whether there's passenger or freight delivery, or merely pleasure flying and training. You look at the nature of the complaint and the remedy requested. What accommodation are they asking for? And when you take all of these factors into consideration, then I think that you can make some sense out of the cases. Because when you have a city that's simply trying to ban all flights from an airport, that's not going to work. That interferes too much with interstate commerce. But when you have a doctor who simply has a heliport on his house that he uses for this, that, and the other, then it's appropriate to say, no, you can't do that. And I'd point out that in this situation, we're not asking for a ban of all flights. We're not asking the judge to sign an order saying that they have to ignore calls from the tower telling them where to fly, or if there's cloud cover that they can't fly over. I mean, we're not saying that. What we're saying is, please stop going in circles around our property every 5 minutes. And it's not like they haven't done it before. I mean, we have worked with Bell before. My clients have worked with them and crafted a solution that was acceptable to everyone. And so it's not, and they have themselves their own areas where they try to avoid. And that's all we're asking is for them to avoid those areas. And so I think that an injunction can be crafted that does not violate preemption and gives my clients the relief that they need. And
what's changed that's caused them to refuse to work with your client?
Honestly, I think it's Ms. Lewis. Ms. Lewis got brought in and replaced, I forgot the gentleman's name. It's not my Lewis. It's the Lewis that works for Bell Helicopter. Before then, there was a gentleman there who was a nice guy. My client went up in a plane or a helicopter with him and said, look, this is what I'm worried about. Can y'all fly along this fence line? The guy said, sure. And so when he was there Mr. Lewis was able to call him, and if there was a problem, if they started flying too close or if they were nosediving over their house or something, he'd just call them and say, hey, look, we've got this problem. And they say, I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. And while he was there, my clients were not, well, it didn't rise to the level of being a nuisance. They were able to work with Bell. But he got replaced in the summer 2 years ago, and this Lewis lady just will not work with him. She won't answer his phone calls, and so
it's very strange because Bell used to have the reputation of being a good neighbor, and this seems very strange for Bell to be behaving like this. But
yeah, well, and the thing is, my clients are no shrinking violets. They've owned that land, has been in their family for years and years. And the minute they moved out there, it was literally a year or two later, they announced the building of the Speedway. And the Speedway is literally across the street from them. But he makes the best of it. I mean, he has trailers parked on his property, and he makes $8,000 or $10,000 every race. And so they try to be good neighbors. And I think that's evidenced by the fact that they would get together and do a flyover and all that. But, you know, once they started flying closer, once they picked up the number of flights and they weren't being responsive, it just got to the point where he felt like this is a nuisance and called me. And I think that's, for our limitations purposes, just to get back to that for just a second, is, you know, I think we created a fact issue as to when there is a nuisance created. And that's all I have.
Any questions?
I was wondering how much your Lewis's property encompasses, and are there other neighbors who are affected?
It's 142 acres, and the flight pattern, well, the flight pattern that they have, I'll tell you this much, to the west is nothing but parole land that's not been developed. And so that's kind of what's so frustrating to my clients, is they could fly their helicopters just a little bit to the west, and it's over nothing. And there are neighbors, there was a neighbor to the north of ours, to the north of us, who's got, cattle or horses, I think it's horses. And when they were flying over to his place, I mean, he went ballistic and somehow got their attention enough to where they don't even mess with him anymore. They just do not fly over his land. So, you know, we think that there is a way for, if they just talk to us, honestly, if we could just work, I think we could work something out to where and it wouldn't interfere with interstate commerce, and it wouldn't run afoul of our preemption issues.
Has this case been mediated since the appeal was filed?
No, ma'am.
Would that help? You think there might
You know, my concern is, honestly, is I think that heliport is for sale. And, you know, they're moving their training facility back into Euless. And I think they may be concerned that they can't enter into any type of agreements for fear of somehow handcuffing their ability to sell the heliport. So that would be a concern I would have if we went to mediation.
Anything else? Okay, thank you.
And I think before, when Mr. Peebles started his argument, he said this is a very fact-intensive type situation. And I think before we get into all the details, it's important to remember what this case is really about. The plaintiffs in their petition and their affidavits say specifically what the purpose is for filing the suit. Lewis does not complain about the presence of the helicopter pad or Bell's right to train pilots using the pad, Rather, Lewis complains about the flight path that has been adopted by the school for training. And he just talked a lot about the flight path there.
Yeah, that it used to be to the west, and everybody was happy, and it was by agreement. And then all of a sudden, y'all started flying closer to the house, and they asked you to move back to the west, and you refused.
Well, we disagree with that recitation of the facts. And there's an affidavit in the record by Barbara Lewis, which is a Bell employee, who he discussed at length, that establishes what the policy is. And in fact, after they went out, before 2011, where they say it got bad, they had been talking to Bell, complaining about the helicopters flying over their house, which is part of our statute of limitations defense. Bell went out, met with them, said, "What do you want from us?" They said, "Fly along the west fence line of our property." When we say they want a no-fly zone, that's what they want. They don't want us flying over their property.
We're not a jury.
No, I understand.
But
they want us to fly along the western fence line. So Bell said, "We will attempt to do that," and established a policy. That policy is reflected in Barbara Lewis's affidavit. But it cannot hold 100% of the time. And an injunction like they are requesting, or damages, which are essentially a fine like they're requesting, amount to forbidding Bell from operating in the navigable airspace over their property, which is preempted explicitly by federal law. Now, because we set out a image of the property, and you can see the direction of the heliports. There's patterns that go east-west. There's patterns that go north-south. That depends on the wind direction. And so there will be days when the pattern goes towards the plaintiff's property. There'll be days when it doesn't. So it's not always possible to avoid it. And this particular area is within the Class D airspace, like in Delta, down from the surface all the way to 3,000 feet. That airspace is assigned to Alliance Airport. So this is an area where aircraft regularly operate. In fact, there are multiple, and the affidavit of Barbara Lewis talks about this also, there are multiple aircraft that operate in the area. So Bell's operations to avoid, as they have a general policy to do, to work with Mr. Lewis, must give way from time to time for necessities of avoiding other air traffic, avoiding weather conditions or clouds, to accommodate for the prevailing winds on that particular day. So we have tried to work with them. And that has been going on fairly consistently since 2005. This facility was built in 2005. So the idea that Bell has refused to work with them is simply not true, and the affidavit of Barbara Lewis says that. And they may be frustrated by it, and it's clear they don't want Bell to fly through the airspace over their property. But that is not something that they can forbid. And we talk about the cases. It's well established across the nation, and in fact, in federal law, that the U.S. government establishes the regulations exclusively for the operation of aircraft in that airspace. And there is no way to craft a state court order without either conflicting with federal law or treading on the United States government's exclusive control of that area of the law. So this, and they say that they're not actually requesting this type of restriction over their property, but we can see that in the injunction they ask for in their petition, which is they seek a temporary and permanent injunction requiring Bell to not use a training flight pattern that travels any further east than Lewis's west property line. That is not an order that, based on the Supremacy Clause, the U.S. Constitution, a state court can make, because this is a unique situation involving aircraft operating in the airspace. It's as simple as that. This is express preemption. And this is not a situation regarding ground usage. When he's talking about it's a fact-intensive inquiry, to a certain extent, I agree with that. Because if this were a case involving an airport and ground usage, then it would be a different scenario. But it's not. It's about operating in the airspace. And in fact, the cases that plaintiffs cite in their petition, the Wood case out of Alabama, actually agrees with our position. It says that the federal government exclusively controls operating in the airspace, but when it comes to privately owned heliports, that's an area where if there's going to be a location, you're going to decide, can someone operate one? That is an area that is reserved to the states. But that's not what this case is about. They said they're not complaining about our operation or use of the heliport. They just don't want us to fly in their airspace. Again, the Beanman case, another case that they cite out of the Seventh Circuit, the same idea. It agrees with our position. And they make a distinction between whether or not there's certain things that a state can do on airports, and there's certain things that the federal government has to do with relating to airspace. And they make it very clear that preemption applies when it relates to airspace. And they say, and this is our greater point about our motion for summary judgment. We move for summary judgment stating that they had to show a federal violation. And they produced no evidence. They said that that wasn't necessary, but because of this unique circumstance, it is necessary. Because of the Supremacy Clause and because of the Federal Aviation Act, it is necessary. And they acknowledge in their brief there is no regulatory violation. So because they can't establish that, and because the law is clear as it relates to federal preemption here, the summary judgment must be affirmed as it relates to the nuisance claim.
Is there an area of the law where federal preemption does not apply because it doesn't speak to a particular situation?
Well, that does occur, but in this particular, it's so explicit in the Federal Aviation Act that it, let's see, I had it here. The United States government has exclusive sovereignty of airspace of the United States. And that is why the factual scenario under which this case arises is so important. Because if this were before a different body of government determining whether or not there could be an airport there or there could be a heliport at the location of Bell's practice area, that would be a different scenario. And I think the Wood case accurately describes that, where a doctor wanted to make a heliport. He told the FAA he was going to build a heliport on his house. He told the city he was going to build a deck. Neither of those two should know what he's really doing. In fact, he's building a deck to land a helicopter at his house. That was an area that the federal regulations don't speak to, that the federal government doesn't get involved in, that kind of ground usage scenario. But this is not a ground usage case. And so there are situations that occur like that. But this is such a very specific situation that it falls directly within the Federal Aviation Act. Does that answer your question?
I think so. This is not something that, if they weren't flying in the, Area D?
Class D,
it
yes.
It would be different, yeah. But it's all airspace.
In this particular, the airspace structure is very complicated, and the FAA has multiple categories, Class A, Class B, Class C, D. And so this is Class D, which is a very specific type relating to an area close to an airport that has an air traffic control tower. Above this area, where the Lewis's property is, above 3,000 feet, it goes into Class B, or Bravo airspace, which is assigned to DFW airports. They go into a different facility. And so, but generally speaking, the navigable airspace, which is basically all the airspace that can be used legally to fly, is governed by the United States government. And the state courts cannot affect rules that would that would tread on that supreme power of the United States government. So this is part of the preemption issue, is this body of regulations that govern this entire airspace structure. And it even gets finer than that, because we've attached a letter of agreement between Bell and the tower that talks about an arrangement that Bell has for getting into the airport and getting out of the airport to get to the practice area. There's even finer rules that just pertain to Bell alone, in addition to the greater body of federal regulations. So there is a lot of rules layered on top pursuant to this authority granted by Congress to the FAA.
Well, apparently, according to plaintiff, until a couple of years ago, y'all had worked things out by agreement and were able to fly along the western line. What changed?
Nothing has really changed. There's no evidence that we have of any change. In fact, the evidence that's in the record says that it's been consistent. That up until whenever they went out to meet, he said Marty Wright, who was a Bell manager for training, went out to meet with the Lewises, and they flew in a helicopter around the property and looked, surveyed the area. And they were there to try to resolve these complaints that had been ongoing for years. And the affidavits that are attached to the MSJ by the Lewises discuss that pre-2011 problems going back and forth where it'd get better and it happened again, it'd get better and it happened again over and over for years. And the policy was instituted, and it remains the policy to, when practicable, fly along the western fence line.
Well, what determines when it's practical?
It's really going to be weather conditions. It's going to be other traffic. It's going to be, this facility is used to train people from all over the world, from governments to private individuals, from, you know, military forces to civilians. And so they get people speaking all kinds of languages, all kinds of skill levels. And so they may give an instruction to stay on the fence line. That student may or may not understand the precise nature of what the fence line is. They may drift. Or they may not have the skill level to maintain that ground track. And so in order to effectively train them, they're going to have to allow them to make mistakes and correct them. And this results in addition to weather, in addition to instructions from air traffic control, in addition to conflicting traffic, will result from time to time.
How high are y'all flying?
It will vary.
I
because
the impression y'all were pretty low, and it wouldn't be a lot of traffic that low, except for police helicopters.
There are other helicopter operators throughout the area, the DEA, the FAA, also flying the area. So,
All right. Well, here's a question I have then. You say only the FAA can make the rules, but when the DEA is flying over or any other police helicopter, they are certainly limited under the Fourth Amendment to how low they can fly and how much of the privacy and expectation of privacy they can invade. And that's determined by state courts as well as federal courts, but not the FAA. So how can that be a total preemption if DEA and other helicopters are limited in how low they can fly by a person's expectation of privacy? So it seems to me there's not the exclusive control you were talking about.
Well, I believe that the U.S. Supreme Court, as well as the congressional mandate to establish the FAA, the Federal Aviation Act, make it clear that the U.S. government determines what can happen in the navigable airspace. Now, if they're descending below the navigable airspace in some kind of super adjacent type of situation.
The Delta airspace was all the way to the ground, so how can they get below that?
Right. In that situation, it does go all the way to the ground. In federally established air traffic control tower controls that. However, there are other regulations that layer on top of it as to how close you can come to buildings. And with helicopters, it's even different because when you're going for landing or takeoff, when you're maneuvering, there's clearance requirements for buildings and people, but it's not the same as for fixed-wing aircraft. And so from time to time, helicopters, when they're landing or taking off, will come and fly low. But that's perfectly legal. And that's what we invited the plaintiffs to do, is say, if we're breaking the law, you need to tell us that, because then it's compensable. Then you still have your state law remedy, but you've got to show that we're violating a federal standard. And they acknowledge that there was no violation. And so that's the evidence that's in the record. So in that situation, the no evidence summary judgment is granted, and it has to be affirmed in that situation. There's not a situation here there's no room here for a state court to craft an order that says that Bell can't fly over their property.
I really do not understand why Bell is insisting on being able to fly in such a way that it creates such a problem when y'all could probably work it out and reach an agreement that would be to the best of our ability. We'll instruct people to fly along the west line, but nobody's offering anything. I mean, this is just to the mat on this thing, and I don't understand that.
Well, we have offered it. I don't know why the plaintiffs chose to file the suit. I guess they found that our execution of our guidance to our pilots wasn't good enough. I think that really it comes down to when a helicopter flies over their property, and this is the point, that we're not the only ones that fly Bell helicopters. Bell manufactures helicopters that are flown by all kinds of people. And so we have a policy, but others may go to the helipads at the motor speedway, and they may pass over his property. If it's a Bell, they're going to run out and say, Bell's doing it again. But it's not us always. And so that's why this order is, that's another reason why this order is not enforceable that they want, is because it's always going to be deemed to be Bell doing it, when in fact we have a policy in place and we're trying to work with them. But anytime a helicopter flies over, they expect it's Bell, and that's not always the case. And Barbara Lewis's affidavit sets that forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On that last issue, just let me state that that's an enforcement issue, and that if the Lewises had a problem with helicopters flying on their land after an order was entered, then the appropriate step would be to file a motion to show cause. And at that point, there would be a hearing, and the court could, and they could come in and say, well, they're our helicopters. When you were talking about why is it that they can't just reach some sort of agreement, that shows you, it shows me how fact intensive an inquiry is. There's something that just doesn't make sense to say that everything that Bell does is preempted and there's not a blessed thing the Lewises can do about it. It just, because there's too many varied facts. What Bell wants to do is they want to say flights, King's X. Anytime you use the word flights, we've got this supremacy clause that says from the ground to wherever. And I just don't buy that. I don't buy that just because we're dealing with flights that you can't have some sort of exception to the preemption issue. And I've always found it strange that they're saying, well, y'all aren't making a ground usage case out of this. And that's because that's just not what my clients want. They're not coming in here saying, sorry, Bell. They're not doing that. We are not doing to Bell what the doctor's neighbors did to him. They ganged up on him, and they said, no flights at all, period. This is a usage issue. You cannot use it. You know, in an effort to be good neighbors, we're not saying you absolutely cannot use this heliport because it's disruptive to everyone. We haven't gone out and petitioned the whole everybody to, you know, bring a class action. And we just want some relief, and I think it can be crafted in a way that Bell doesn't have to worry about helicopters that aren't theirs, clouds in the sky, calls from the control tower telling them what to do. I just don't think flight is that monolithic. I think you can set out a series of factors to consider, and that kind of brings me back to where we are with this. We're on a motion for summary judgment, and they feel like just because we want to restrict them, we want to push them 200 yards to the west, that all of a sudden we're out of court. And I just think that my clients ought to have a chance to develop the facts, and once the facts are developed, then I guess we could come back up here and see whether or not we're asking for a preemption. But under the circumstances, I don't think we are. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. You answered some of our questions. We appreciate it. And your case is submitted. We'll recess briefly to switch the panels. In the meantime, you're free to go about your business, or you're free to stay and watch the next case be argued if you'd like to.
All right. The Honorable Court of Appeals.